I like being big. I like exerting energy and showing up and shining and all of that shit, but it has to be so specific for me. I'm such a fussy little bitch about it.
Hello and welcome to Neo Bohemia. I'm your host, Charlie Layton. We're talking today about success, what it means when things start going well for you, how do you handle success, what it's like to get a break in your struggles as an artist. And with me today to talk about success is Nati Vogel. Hi, Nati.
Hi, Charlie.
Nati is a musician, an artist, a performer, and you're having a bit of a break right now. Things are going well.
Part of that might be the fear to even admit it when it's going well, and I just felt that. I was like, do I agree with him?
Yeah.
Do I disagree with him?
Yes. We have a lot to talk about regarding success. Personally, I find myself often very superstitious. You know, don't talk about your dreams when things are successful because you'll jinx it. And I'm also, sometimes I'm cynical in that I don't know when things are actually going well or I'm not recognizing success. But you've just released an EP.
Yeah.
You're getting some press and some momentum. And,
yes. And accurate. That's factual.
Yes. Yeah, so this is factual evidence.
Stick to facts.
Of success for a musician, which is great. And you're on Spotify, but I'll pay you.
On Venmo?
Yes.
That's my preferred. I've been telling everyone to pay me on Venmo, for the record, since, you know, most people out there know you don't get paid from Spotify or iTunes, really.
Right, iTunes. Right, so
Venmo's best. Thank you. But thank you for that.
Yeah, so get him on Spotify, but then Venmo him directly.
Yeah, at Nati-Vogel. It's not hyphen, sorry, it's a dash. I'm terrible at this. My Venmo animal is... And my Venmo animal? My Venmo animal is a unicorn.
Ooh.
And my handle is at Natti-Vogel. Yeah. If you want artists to get paid or eat breakfast.
What's the name of your new album?
My new album is called Serving Body.
Serving Body. And,
yeah.
And there are a few... There's a single on it from a previous release.
There is a single on it that was previously released by itself in advance of the record called Cannibal.
Yeah.
And that did well, but it took a really long time to get the full album out because of money.
Right.
Because art takes money, believe it or not.
Art takes money.
And some of us weren't born into it, also, believe it or not.
So I remember reading somewhere you said there are 6 songs on this EP.
Yeah.
And for each song, it took, what, a year?
Yeah. I hate to say that, but that's also factual.
So I think that this success is deserved. If you told a musician it's going to take a year for every song on your EP release, would they say, no thanks, I quit now? Or would they say, okay, at least I know that it's going to be this much time?
Yeah, there's so many different ways to think about those years now with the benefit of hindsight. But as I was doing it, all I could think was, I have to survive, I have to live, and I have to make this music. So there was no guarantee of timing and either way. Like, right, there was no big picture. It was really just, how do I get this out there?
Right.
From day to day. And it's embarrassing and kind of shameful to admit that it took so long, because I like to think of myself as someone who gets things done and has determination and is resourceful and is, you know, I'm not a passive artist, like, waiting for some guy with a big cigar to come down from the sky and say, baby, you're a star,
right,
and take me to Hollywood. I've never been that type of person, so it's kind of jarring to think that it took me that long, and why didn't I get my act together sooner, and why didn't I... But I was getting my act little by little together gradually in the best ways I knew how at any given time.
So you're on time for you.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I guess so. It feels, yeah, I'm definitely over this, and getting over the shame of how long it took.
That's great. You also have music videos then.
Hell yeah. I have 2 music videos.
I just saw the new one. You're dancing.
I'm in a solo dance music video. It's called I Don't Want to Find the One.
Oh.
Yeah.
Fantastic. How was that experience?
I always loved to dance ever since I was little. I would throw these birthday parties of me dancing and making all the other kids dance. And I think at some point in my composer's journey, because that's what I went to school for, I apprenticed a composer, I like forgot that the body was so important to me. All of my music is earthy. It's all about bodies. It's all about like movement and yeah, shit like that. So it made sense for me to do a solo dance music video. And I just had to do it. I had to do it.
For those of you just meeting Nati for the first time, he plays the piano and he sings, but if you were to watch him perform live, he barely sits in the bench. He's usually very animated and he's either standing up a second later or just doing some form of choreography.
I'm like, if you were to even just see me now in this apartment, I realize now that Charlie told you that I got very self-conscious because I realized I'm like, my hands are flying around and my neck is flying around and my legs are shifting. Yeah, it's a very bodily experience being me, and I wanted to, you know, kind of get that under control with a little bit of choreo. Mm-hmm. So we got my friend Jose Rivera Jr., who's also this brilliant queer artist, and I spent months talking about what it would be like to tell I Don't Want to Find the One, to tell the story of I Don't Want to Find the One. There's a song. And it made total sense because the music comes from my body. I write the body of work. I write the lyrics, I write the music. For me, it all comes from a sense of sensation. Mm-hmm. So it made sense to tell this story in my bodily form. It was my very first time doing it, so people have been very kind to say that it was good. I promise to anyone who isn't feeling as kindly towards it that I will get better as I do more. So I do want to do more dance music videos.
That's awesome.
In the future.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I guess let's start from the beginning. When did you know when you wanted to be an artist?
Oh, man. I knew that I wanted to be a musical artist pretty late in the game. Like, when I was 17, that's when I was feeling more like a writer. I was writing more songs, mm-hmm. all of a sudden. But before that, I wrote songs as jokes. Mm-hmm. So in my brain, it wasn't happening.
In high school.
And as an elementary school kid and, like, in middle school with, like, my neighbors. And I would, yeah, and I would, like, write songs for people's middle school film projects. And, like, I would just, but it was always, like, this is a joke. So in my brain, I wasn't writing songs. I was, like, not taking myself seriously. Mm-hmm. But I would have these visions, weirdly. Like, I would have these visions. As a little kid that I had a record and I was on the cover of a record. And it was kind of strange. And I have these, yeah, I would just have these little visions. I wouldn't tell anyone about it. I wouldn't take it seriously. I was, like, you know, studying classical violin at the time, which at that time was in no way cool or integrated into mainstream music at all. So I didn't see the path for that. Yeah, it was just only when I was 17, that's when I was like, wow, I think I'm writing songs that objectively stand up to the quality of songs that I really love to listen to. And I would, like, compare them, which I know you're told not to do. Taylor Mack, who I've worked for, says comparison is violence. But I wanted to know if I was worthy of joining that world. And I looked next to the song, I looked the songs next to each other, and I thought, like, you know, mine has structural integrity, their songs have structural integrity. This is dynamic, this is unique, like, I can go forward with this. And then, so I changed my major to music composition, and they were like, wow, you're terrible at notating music, but you know what you're doing, so, like, you can work on notation, that's not
good. Where were you going to school?
Manus.
Oh, cool.
Upper West Side. And they were like, you know, whatever, you can learn notation. And they were right. Notation spooked me out at first, but then it became fine. It was just, like, another math class or something. But it was like that year was full throttle. Within 3 months, I had written like a whole crazy new body of work, like 10 to 12 songs. I made an EP with a backing band, submitted to Battle of the Bands at New School University, which is huge, which has not just Madness, but also the jazz school. It also has like the indie pop farm of Lang, which is like the liberal arts school within. So it was like a lot of competition. Somehow weirdly, I know who helped me get in, who, like, put my tape to the people, or CD, or whatever it was at the time, to the people, was this wonderful bridal couture designer, Samantha Sleeper, and she handed the CD into the judges, and I think she was the breaking vote you know, to get me in the Battle of the Bands, and then I ended up winning.
Won
Battle of the Bands, baby. Yeah.
What year was this?
I was 18. It was freshman year. But I was, like, definitely surprised that it was so quick.
Right.
From choosing to write seriously to getting that reaction. And they were all, my band loved alcohol, and I thought it was okay. And they went and did a bunch of, they just went and partied and, like, celebrated and got real drunk. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I decided to take this little pilgrimage, this little solo pilgrimage in the West Village. And I went to this 24/7 cafe called Cafe Esperanto. Mm-hmm. And Rufus Wainwright was playing. But I didn't know who, I knew of him. I knew he was a gay dude that, like, was fancy. But I hadn't heard his music. And then this song played, and I was like, damn, this is good. So I went up to the barista. I was like, who is this? This kind of sounds like Beck, but better. Mm-hmm. Like Beck if he were smarter musically. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, oh, this is Rufus Wainwright. And I saw it as this weird little sign. I was like, I knew I was gay. Like, I knew Rufus Wainwright was gay. It was this very rich music. It took itself seriously, but it was also, like, fun and playful. And I was just alone in this cafe, like, journaling and finding out who Rufus Wainwright was, alone, the night that I won Battle of the Bands at 18, figuring, like, this felt like, bitch, this is what you're doing. Like, here's your path. Take it.
So soon, too, to just switch a major and then, on the first outing, win, be a champion of Battle of the Bands, the same night, find, like, a central influence and then get a sense of, like, a trajectory.
Yeah. I felt guided. It felt like when I took that walk from dinner to the cafe that there was some like force with me, and it was like, you're like, here you are, you're alive, you're present, like, this is your path, like, walk it, you're here.
That's nice. Since then,
it hasn't been a straight path at all. Oh my god.
Right, so it's been a long and winding road to get to
this
place, and soon to wherever else you're headed.
Yeah, other places, hopefully.
Fast forward, so when did you have the ideas for the songs that would become this album?
Each song, I would say the earliest, the song that I started writing the earliest was Cannibal, which was 2010, spring 2010.
Right.
And then, that was the earliest. And the latest, the last song, in terms of writing, not in terms of production. Mm-hmm. The last song in terms of production was Love for a Limited Time Only, and that was done this last month.
Wow.
And that's been a lot of the blog's favorites. And I'm like, well, yeah, because people get better over time. Next question.
Right,
like,
so
it's
the,
obvious. The like, I figured out my production groove now. I know how to work it, but...
If I may be so blunt, why does it take that long for these songs?
Money takes... It takes money because... Yeah, it takes money to...
To make them sound good.
Well, I mean, I think they sound great piano solo, but they're not, that's not, it wasn't my vision. Like, you know, I could have, you're right. I mean, I go back and I'm like, damn, I totally could have done a piano solo record and just spared myself all of this trauma. Mm-hmm. But, like, I think that people need to understand it's, I would say primarily money. Mm-hmm. Still.
Studio time, producers.
Yeah, I would say also the money that it takes for me to, like, you know, I have to gig to live, so that takes up your time. You're not just writing all the time and having, you don't just have unlimited time to, like, fundraise a record, mm-hmm. you know. You have a limited time to fundraise a record. And then you also have, you know, a limited time to make all the connections necessary to find the right arrangement. There were, oh my God, you don't even know. I don't even want to go into it. There's so many stages. It's like, you can look at this and be like, why did it take him 6 years? But if you knew, girl, if you knew, it was like there were arrangements made for Moonshine Melody and Brown Rice that just didn't work for the songs. There were arrangements made for Brooklyn that I had to veto.
That it's only 6 songs and it's a tidy EP, but I can tell that the construction and the composition on these have been very, 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 very well thought after, considered, laid out, produced. Like, it's a very, very strong album.
Thank you.
And it takes, and the it sounds beautiful. It's very, very well made. And I think that's a success. And I can hear the idea. I can hear so much consideration and love that went into these six songs.
I'm so glad because, yeah, if you don't want to clock the hours that you spend mixing notes or, you know, re-recording a piano section or even just making the damn songs. But then once you do, you're like, oh my God, this has been so much work, and it's all in the service of, whoa, you know, even the title, like, which took me a while to come up with, the title is in service of people. So why did I want this crazy vision? It wasn't because, like, I wanted to be, you know, go out there blinging and stunting and, like, great and, like, rich strings, although that's fun too. Mm-hmm. But, and, like, rich winds. It's because I wanted to give people pieces that they could play millions of times over and still find new layers. Mm-hmm. Just like a gift, like something that I might want, something just super, super rich and sensual and, like, ambiguous and ambivalent and just something that stands up and like continues to nurture you, not just a disposable thing. So I could have totally done a piano and vocal record, but I didn't want, I mean, fundamentally, and there were a lot of people that advised me to just do that. They were like, just get it out there. Just get your name out there, get your recordings out there, because it's more practical. Like, mm-hmm. You'll reach more people, it'll be easier. They were like, you'll get more credit because people will see that you're a pianist and they'll see that, mm-hmm. you know, they can more centrally locate my musical ideas as belonging to me since I write them all. So they're like, it's better for you, it's better for everything, do that. And my only answer is I just didn't want to do that. I just heard these pieces so... Like, when I'm at the piano, I'm limited. I just have 88 keys and me, and I come up with as many interesting parts as I can. Like, for example, the clarinet you hear on the intro to Cannibal, that comes from my right hand, and the trombone comes from my left. And, you know, there's a little line that I used to play on the piano, but then I created a new line, so I gave the old line to a clarinet. For example, like, it's all coming from these, you know, musical ideas I have on my piano. But you can't achieve all of those textures and vibrations and colors just simply with the piano. And, you know, these were worlds that they're supposed to be intricate and they're supposed to be transporting. And I wanted to transport people in that way. And, yeah, and it sounds impractical. I just really wanted to do it. And I don't know why I, like, didn't have a good reason. I don't know, it's just like, it has to be rich. It has to be as rich as it possibly can be. Also, what really struck me as important that every one of the songs is super introverted.
Yeah.
So, like, these are all really, like, self-reflective songs, or, like, they're songs that are about the conflict of self versus self. And I love that introversion is big. Like, the introversion can be this big grand thing, like that our feelings inside are richer than all the circuses that we see outside. I love that concept, especially because I got criticized early on with Cannibal that from someone in the industry that they were like, why is it big and orchestral? But it's just a monologue, like, to yourself. Like, so it's like a soliloquy. And I was like, well, why the fuck not? Like, I think getting that criticism fueled me more, because I was like, well, I love the fact that these are these grand introverted things.
Do you identify as an introvert?
No. Because
I wouldn't say.
I don't identify as an introvert, but I read something interesting that Cynthia von Bueller posted, that a colleague of both of ours, mm-hmm. a very creative person, posted this article about the traits of, highlighting traits of creative people, and one of them was that they're introverted and extroverted at the same time. Sure. I really like that one, because there's been so much memification and popularization of introvert versus extrovert,
yeah.
traits, that it's like, which one are you? And then there's the Myers-Briggs, and of course, like, I lean towards extroverted, obviously.
But you're very sensitive.
Yeah, super sensitive.
I guess then we just have to get past the misconception that extroverts are not, you know, taking sensory yeah. information, or that they they're not capable of subtlety, nuance, or internalizing things.
Right. Sometimes I feel like my extroversion is a way to amplify energies that already exist around me, mm-hmm. in many ways. Like, I feel like putting something out there doesn't mean you're just putting you out there. I don't know. It's really, yeah, definitely over the dichotomy, however you slice it.
Sure.
And like,
no more binaries ever.
No more binaries on, like, all things, please.
Just spectrum.
Just nuance and shit. And, like, I feel like, I don't know, it's funny because, you know, I realize, like, I don't like singing cover songs.
Okay.
Unless that cover song has hit me, like, has hit me really deeply in my gut, and then I decide I have something unique to shine a light on in that song. And, like, if that makes sense, it's like...
Do you have an example?
Yeah, I just did the one cover I did in my last show at National Sawdust was Quicksand by SZA.
Wow.
Do you know that song? It's so pretty. It's actually not off her record. It's off the Insecure soundtrack, which is a great show on HBO.
Yes.
Then
I've heard it.
Well, you've heard like maybe 10 seconds of it, which is interesting because the piece, I don't remember if, I don't actually, I've gotten so into this song that I don't remember its placement in the show, but it's like, should I assume you didn't mean it like that? Should I assume you know exactly how you said it? You know exactly how you meant it? Should I assume that it's in peace? Sweet disposition, switching position, ducking submission. Should I assume it's a weekend thing? It's just so like serpentine, mm-hmm. and it's so surprising and so contradictory. I also feel like there's so many layers that she's experiencing when she's writing this, and I just empathically heard this song. I was like, now I have to do this cover, and I almost like I almost backed out at soundcheck, and then Katie, who's the artist coordinator at National Sound, just like, don't you not play that song? And then it turned out to be. Like, everyone really liked the song, and they looked up the song, and they got into it. But I don't know why that relates to introversion, extroversion with me. It's just that, like, I like being big. I like exerting energy and showing up and shining and all of that shit. But it has to be so specific for me. I'm such a fussy little bitch about it. There is no part of me that wants to extrovert for the sake of it. There is no part of me that wants to step out on that stage just to look pretty. But on my own terms, I only want to show up if I'm certain that I have something to add to the conversation, something new that's good.
Okay. So in that sense, that's the sensitivity of your extroversion?
Yeah.
That it has to come from a deep internal, personal, sensitive place of personal expression.
Yeah.
Not just big for the sake of big.
Yeah, and also a deep... an obsessive attunement to where other people are at and what they might need and want from me. Because it's like, okay, I could do my own deep, sensitive, personal catharsis in my bedroom. There are a lot of bedroom songwriters, and they're amazing, and I love them. But that's not how I'm wired. Like, I can't just be confessional. Like, even SZA, who she talks about this, she's just like, I can't write for other people. Like, even when Rihanna told her, like, it was Rihanna just took a song that she had, you know, written for herself, or like she's like her pen game is so strong, and everybody will tell you that it comes from, it's between her and God only. Like, it's totally her doing her thing. For me, it's a little different. I have this like obsession with wondering where the scales are balanced in society, like whose voices are being diminished, what types of things are being said or not being said, what types of feelings are okay and which are taboo. And I, like, have at least several, like, pieces of software in, like, my right brain alone, like, running, like, getting a feel for that. And then, so it's, like, the intersection. It's always, for me, like, it sounds weird. I've never explained it this way before. It's a weird intersection between all of that and me getting really... trying to get really sensitive with what's going on deep from a deep personal substantive place and finding the overlap. What a marvelous ride, never seen a scene quite so seated. We're the life of the party when daddy see like they mean it. But if they wanted to connect, if they wanted to inspect, then they'd do it instead of trying to convince us that they're fabulous. With fabulous, it's all just sticking to my tongue, sticking to my mouth, man. Gotta get it out before I choke, 'cause I don't.
one. That's just an idiot fantasy that we're waiting on again. No, I don't wanna find the one. That isn't love enough.
That was Nati Vogel with I Don't Want to Find the One off his new album, Serving Body. You can check him out on iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud. Hey, if you like what you hear, please consider making a donation directly to Nati at his Venmo account, which is at Nati-Vogel. That's Natti-Vogel, because music artists don't really make that much money online. It all goes to the streaming companies. So think about it. All right, now back to our program. I have a strange, scary question. What would be your idea of failure?
Are we on the record?
Yeah.
My idea of failure... Oh, there's so many ways to fail. I feel like I could come out with like a... Because I have Eastern European Jewish blood in me too. Mm-hmm. I have Sephardic Jewish blood in me, which is where I get my swagger. But I also have like high anxiety coming from the Eastern European Jewish side. Mm-hmm. So there's a million ways to fail if you're Eastern European Jewish. And you've considered all of them, right? And there's also like the Holocaust trauma in your blood. So like, I feel like most of the most like immediately egregious, scary ways to fail, like, they don't happen on a daily basis, so I'm good. Like, you know, I'm not pursued by, like, wild beasts on a daily basis. I've, like, managed to eat on a daily basis, which is great. I don't have any life-threatening diseases. I'm not even going bald. Like, I'm good. Like, on a day-to-day basis, like...
So you have your health and well-being.
I'm scared, like, of a lot of things all the time. And, like, when I get unknown numbers, I think it's, like... Do you know those Indian dudes that play the IRS scam?
Yeah.
Like, I bought into it for the first 35 minutes. Because, like, I have these nightmares that, like, some bureaucratic mistake is... you know, becomes the inciting incident of my downfall. Mm. So, like, I'm scared of And I was once wrongly jailed. So, like, I do have a real experience of that.
Of the anxiety.
In this lifetime, wow. as me, Nati. So I do have a lot of that fear. But it's specifically as it relates to career, so I know I'm beating around the bush, is, like, different ways I could fail. So many different ways. I think the realest way that I think I could fail is just, like, I think the scariest things are probably the things that are the most likely.
Mm-hmm.
So, would to me at least, in my own brain, and maybe one of my deepest fears is that the music that I make never gets to reach all the people that could benefit from it. That's it. That's what failure would be for me, and that sums it all up, is that that's what failure would be for me. If not me being, you know, as poor as I am now in 10 years, although I'd love to be richer, you know, not me, like, dying alone, because, like, you know, it'd be nice to have a great partner who I'm in love with, but, like, also that doesn't spook me as much as, like, the thing that spooks me the most would be tons of people that could benefit and enjoy and be healed and be, like, generally have their lives augmented and bettered by the things that I make, not having the access to them, would be failure for me, for sure.
Wow. As far as a sense of failure, that's a great motivator to avoid and get your sound out there.
I know, which drives me crazy, because sometimes I'm like, I don't want to be too driven to get it out there at the expense of, like, actually making it and staying in my truth as an artist. Right. So it's one that I have to navigate.
Of overexposure?
I don't fear overexposure, because I just think that's, like, a marketing term.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just, like, I think the wrong people care about that. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a very smart word. Like, I'm like, are the people who need to be hearing my music hearing them? That's all I care about.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care about being trendy, or, like, if someone's like, you know, what was, like, you know, you hear things like all the time, like, oh, I just hear this song everywhere now. I'm like, great. Well, then the person who really needed to hear that song, like, obviously I don't believe in, like, invasive exposure, like that YouTube Apple record. Like, I don't believe in invasive exposure,
mm-hmm.
but I think that, you know, for the people that, like, really love that U2 album, I saw someone post that on Facebook the other day, like, unpopular opinion, like, I love that U2 album. But, I mean, that's invasive, so I don't want to be invasive, but I want to be available for anyone that could benefit.
Totally.
And that's something that I have to manage, because I want to, yeah, because I can't control necessarily how available I am. I can really only control... I don't even know what I can control. That's a whole other question that Sis and I need to talk about for, like, an hour.
Aside from failure, I have an actual fear of breaking my fingers as an accordionist.
Oh, yeah. No, that's very real. Yeah. Do you have that shit insured?
No.
So, yeah.
You got your fingers insured?
I don't have my fingers insured, but if I... If I... I should probably have my throat insured, if anything. I'm like, yeah. If I don't play piano, like... No big deal. I mean, it's still a big deal. That would suck. I definitely mm-hmm. want my fingers. We should get our shit insured.
Yes, when we get the money for that, too.
When we get, it's money. It's all coming. I'm glad we're back to grounding.
Yes.
It is about money. Money matters. Great.
Right.
I was going to say that, like, what I do really want to be transparent about is money and time.
Okay.
So, you know.
The time and the money that you've sunk into.
Yeah, not as like, look how much I put into this at all. It's more of like a, and this is no shade to, like, people who had everything handed to them, and this is no shade, you know, to people that came from a ton of money at all, because there's no shame about that. I just want people to have a realistic idea of what it's like for people that didn't.
Right.
And I also want, I don't want young artists out there looking at the types of people who had everything handed to them and not knowing, and looking at themselves and saying, why aren't I there yet? And not, like, giving themselves some fucking slack. Because it's like, I think things are going to change, but traditionally in the music industry, even with Rufus Wainwright, he got grandfathered and his father was in the industry. It's like an aristocracy. This is no shade to Rufus. We should just be able to talk about it. Mm. Like, you should know that, and I'm not saying this to be a downer. I'm actually saying this to, hopefully, as an inspirational story, is like, listen, like, I'm starting to get attention and breaks now, and I'm not going to stop anytime soon, but it wasn't easy for me. And if there are people out there who think, wow, it should be easy for me, and then they get burnt out and quit, like, I don't want that to happen. I don't want people out there looking at like, these really big artists and thinking that that it was...
overnight?
Yeah, and I don't want them to look at, like, a Lady Gaga and a Rufus Wainwright and think, like, oh, I wish I could be like them. It's like, no, honey, you weren't born with a ton of money. It's fine. Like, you weren't born with a dad who, you know, could just hand your record to someone at Capitol and make it work. Like, and that's fine, too. Like, I don't want us to... I was... Like, I'm not articulating this super well, but...
I think... Okay, so... Like, if I'm hearing you, I think there is... Especially in young people... There will probably be an image of success that they see on television, film, media, Instagram, and are not quick to look at the process, because there is a process to anyone's success.
Yes.
Some processes are easier, but others are much more time-consuming and labor-intensive and expensive.
Yes.
And... I mean, there are all these different paths to get to success.
Yeah.
Yours was particularly challenging, I think.
Long and arduous,
Long and arduous to get to this first big EP.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a message that I relate to a lot. I believe in the merits of hard work.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you've worked so hard and that you're finally... reaping the benefits of your work. And I think that that's a message that everyone should hear. Sometimes it's easier for other people. I think it's the next one might be easier. If you wrote one of these songs a month ago, then the process of, you know, writing, producing, you may streamline it over time.
Yeah, I mean, I really hope so. Like, when I think about it now, I probably wrote so many songs... Well, so it took me a lot. I'll say that it took a while for me to feel comfortable enough making that post that you read.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is, as we talked about in the beginning, a little shame involved in it. And this is what I want people out there to feel. Like, mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? This is the kind of thing is that we've been sold this Horatio Alger's pick yourself up by your bootstraps myth in society that, like... You know, if you're not at the top of whatever field you are now, it's because you're just not working hard enough. And it's mm-hmm. like, that's not true. There are people that literally inherited it. There are tons of people. And that, and as we're seeing with more economic research that's coming out, it's increasingly true that those with inherited wealth do increasingly better.
Oh, yeah.
And that's becoming, I mean, we're headed towards...
opportunities and privilege.
Yeah. And so, you know, the world was different when my grandfather, who came from a small town in Ohio, when grandpa's dad... ran a little convenience store and they were the only Jews in this small Midwestern town. It's different for him at that time to have the opportunity to really, really work hard and then get at the top of his game as a Harvard professor and then become like an international diplomat and advisor to leaders of several nations. And like, he's had an incredible, incredible career. He's a very modest person, but I'm not sure how many Ezra's would be possible today,
right?
You know, in 2018. I think that, I'm not trying to start a revolution with this podcast necessarily, although I wouldn't mind. I just think the revolution first has to be one of consciousness. And the consciousness has to be, if you wake up today upset because you're not where you want to be, don't be, because there's,
We're often prone to overlooking that a strong part of personal success is personal fulfillment. Like, I think success is very often turned into an image or some sort of product or some sort of result rather than a day-to-day process.
Totally. And the process is more loving. It's more caring. It's more sweet. It's like, if you imagine, like, everyone's like, I want a boyfriend. I want a bae. I want a girlfriend. I'm like, you want that partner because that partner's there with you through the process. If you surround yourself by people that you care about and that care about you, it's like the difference between me having this podcast with you on the floor right now and thinking, God, I wish I were talking to Bill Boylan from NPR, right? Which right. I could be thinking that. Or I could be like, this is so dope. This is so cool. I get to be my total self. Your hat matches my blanket. I love Charlie. He's so funny. He's so brilliant. I love my floor. I love my crazy, messy apartment that I've worked so hard to keep and pay the rent for and make my own and only my own. And, like, all these ways that we could be loving our process more. And one of them is by not, like, blindly worshiping people that have it easier than you. I think. I really do. I think that so much of social media is, like, this thirst trap of, like, this person has better abs than you. This person, like, came out with 5 more records than you.
Right. Or some things that you...
You don't know their deal. You don't know their process.
Right. Like, maybe, and also, either they worked really hard for it, or may be something you don't even want.
Right. Maybe they're crying at night. Maybe they don't even write their own songs, and maybe you want the joy of writing your own song. Maybe you love the creation. Like, there's so many maybes. There's so many unknowns that we never need to...
Right.
Never need to get out of our own self-care mode. Like, right.
And in the process of looking at those results, you may forget, well, actually, I'm doing really, really well right now.
Also, I'm receiving so much, like, I'm receiving so much love and support and help. And, like, I do, that's something that's really blown my mind throughout this whole process is, like, you know, I talk about how I hesitated to make that post for so many reasons, and one of them was... Are the people who did help make this record possible going to look at this and be like, he's really ungrateful?
That it took so long.
And I hope that doesn't come across, because I hope it didn't come across. I hope it didn't sound ungrateful, because it's not. It doesn't come from... It comes from a place of wanting transparency. But hopefully I feel like it... If anything, like, that it emboldens the people, that it emboldens and ennobles the people who were part of it, because these are people that loved me, you know, that I loved, and that some of them, like, they played for peanuts, for, like, you know, way below what they should be paid, and I would do favors, I would sing for them for free or whatever, you know, and, like, I hate the barter system, I hate the, I believe artists should be paid the most, but it's, like, if you're, like, 22 and trying to make your first single, like, holy fuck, what are you gonna do? Mm-hmm. I don't know. And it's magical. Like, all I want, and looking back at this journey, like, there is also that care of, like, who was with me in the process. There was, like, so many magical people who, I mean, I love. I loved making this record with these beautiful people. And the only reason why they were part of this is because they really liked the music and they liked me and they liked, you know, and they're masochistic. I don't know why. But they put in their time and their love, and I just think it's amazing. When I listen to these songs, I think about the faces in the booth, and I think about, like, the long nights spent mixing with Mike or with Roth. And that process is... It kind of, like, I'll cry if I think about it too long, because it's just so... It's so sweet and scary and brave and weird to just... To show up, maybe in their minds, they're like, oh, I know he's going to be a success and I'm going to, you know. But I really don't think so. I think it was just, you know, there's this messy kid, me, with, like, ADD and, like, rips in his, like, nice jacket. Like, I was so weird, like, at the time. I was, like, I mean, I'm just thinking back to these early days of making, like, I can't have seemed like, you know, I can't have seemed like a winner. So I think that these people really just did it out of love and because they liked the music and the fact that they were brave and I was brave and that we all just kind of jumped into all of this together is great.
Do they, maybe they believed in the same thing that you did, that the idea of what this goal might be or what this album might be?
Yeah, maybe they did. I mean, that's a really good suggestion. I'm trying to think where everybody is at now in their careers and their lives and how we all are doing the same thing. And I will say that there is this kind of thesis that maybe the record has on, like, a technical level that I've always held, and espoused, which is that I want to take the best of what makes pop and hip hop really magical, mm-hmm. and the best of what makes classical music really magical and alternative and progressive music really magical, and I want to marry them. Mm-hmm. And that's always been my mission from a subconscious level, probably ever since I was little. I was obsessed with opera and mostly like late romantic opera, but I was a classical slut. I'd listen to anything classical for hours, and I'd also listen to Jam 94.5, the hip hop station, for hours. And like, that was just me as a little kid. So I think loving both of those styles of music as passionately as I always have felt crazy, mm-hmm. because how do we mix them? And of course, I know that there are strings in hip hop music. I get it. Like, I get that, you know, whatever, you know, you can get a dope beat from like even Verdi operas. Like he really gets into a good flow occasionally, you know, but it's different. Like I've always wanted to alchemize them. And I think that the people who worked on this record with me also were passionate about that. I think that these are, if we're getting real specific here, like the crew who made this with me, it's all super hyper intelligent, educated people who come from a conservatory background.
Okay.
Who are sick of conservatory life, mm-hmm. culture, music, everything. And we just wanted to take what we loved about being classical musicians, more or less, and being heirs to the classical tradition, or supposed heirs, or like, it was kind of grappling with like, what am I going to keep in this? Like, what am I going to, but knowing I'm a songwriter, so how does that come through? It's obviously not just like throw a bunch of strings on it. Yeah. Nobody was interested in whole notes. Or, you know what I mean? Like, or like thirds, like that's for sure. If you were fucking with my music at the time, and I've since learned how to make more accessible music, and I don't want to find the one as the first example of that on the record. It's like track three, hands down. That's like my
pop song.
My attempt at taking the average of me and pop and serving you that. Yeah, but it was like, you know, even that one, it's weird. It starts on F dominant, goes to a D flat. You never know what key you're in. What key are you in? And I don't want to find the one. You tell me. But everyone was down with that. Everyone was like, everyone loved hip hop. Everyone loved pop, but everybody also wanted something more the mm-hmm. whole time. And they didn't want to just like let all of their hard work, because classical musicians are so rigorous. Mm-hmm. Even when I thought I was going to be a violinist, like 4 hours a day, that kind of shit. All these etudes, all these scales, yeah. all this, like, that's insane.
So, like, such a high shelf of reward. I mean, just to get the vibrato on the first 2-3 years.
Oh, first 5 years. The first 2-3 years, you're lucky if you can get, like, anything but a cat screech out of you. I mean, honestly, I started when I was 4. God bless anyone that had to suffer me. Yeah. Through the first couple of years, yeah.
Yeah, violin of any instrument I can think of is one of the least rewarding at the onset.
Yeah, definitely, like, for the parents. No, for me, I remember, it's true. Because, like, I loved Sound of Music at the time and memorized all these musicals. And I kind of wanted to play, like, the Lonely Goat Herd. Like that part.
Yeah.
And so I got the sheet music and I, you know, I just got my violin. No lessons, mind you. But little me thought I could just pick it up and figure it out.
Yeah.
That was so humbling. So maybe it's kind of like that with making this record. It's like you have this idea, you have this vision, mm-hmm. and you think it's just going to pop out, but it doesn't. And there are ways, you know, and that fundraising and doing the business side of it is another set of skills that they don't teach you in school. And that, you know, that they don't teach you in music school. They don't teach you at most schools. I mean, even if you're going to business school, music business is different. To sum up, like, I think that I felt in a way like when I started to do singer-songwriter, when I started to know that I was a singer-songwriter, even while I was doing the classical stuff, it became very clear to me that this was, like, better. It was just better because I knew what all of this music was going to amount to. I knew what all of this training was going to amount to. And I could see I could see all of those hours and those years becoming useful.
Well, thank you, Nati, for coming on the podcast. This has been great talking to you. We're going to conclude with one of your singles from the EP.
So exciting.
We All Moved to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
It's a great, beautiful song. This was Nati Vogel, and I'm Charlie Layton, and this was Neo Bohemia. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, Charlie.
Since I've seen your face, I was just about to ask, how have you been? But before I could, you jumped in with a, where are you living these days? Said I'm one block away from the J. Couple stops past the Williamsburg Bridge for Manhattan. And you said, don't you find it odd that we all moved to Brooklyn? Yeah, we all moved to Brooklyn. We all moved to Brooklyn in the end. My choice, and I'll have you know it's not cause the rents were high, they're actually higher here. I pay for the distance from the advertisements. And you said, do you think that when we die, our souls move to Brooklyn? That our souls fly to Brooklyn. Yeah, we all move to Brooklyn when we die. Plus, I heard your mom, she too moved to Brooklyn, and the word on the street is Wall Street's moving to Brooklyn too. Why? Cause we all moved to Brooklyn. We all moved to Brooklyn. We all moved to Brooklyn. We all moved. We all move on board. We all move to Berlin. 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 We all.